She was called Mary Frances Hill Hill.
Mary Hill was a name, it's an order.
Yeah, Hill.
Hill. Well, we're just a couple minutes after, so I think let's go ahead and get started. Thank you for being here, everyone. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm an actor and a director from Minneapolis, and we've been doing a couple days' work on exploring the world of theater and drama here on this. Today, what I'd really like to talk about is the journey of what a director goes through, and this is really sort of the nuts and bolts or kind of practical step-by-step approach of going, as we say, from the script page, from getting a show and reading a play to opening night. So what does that production process look like? It's different really for all different kinds of directors, and all different kinds of directors do a lot of different kinds of shows. Well, there's me up at the top with that halo above me.
Oh, I can't quite make it out.
Yes. So I've had the opportunity to direct maybe about 50 shows or so, a whole bunch of different things ranging from Shakespeare production with youth, a summer stock production of The Full Monty, a production of Lysistrata, which I'll be going into rehearsal doing another production of that as soon as I get back, a community theater production of Christopher Durang's Beyond Therapy, a really contemporary comedy, and a small theater professional production of The Miracle Worker, right there. So like a lot of directors, I go from project to project and work at a lot of different places around town. But like most directors, you end up over time sort of developing your own sort of way of doing things. But this will be sort of a generalized approach, sort of talking a little bit about how directors do it. Here are a bunch of famous directors right here, where we see Meryl Streep over there with Mike Nichols, very famous Broadway director. Peter Brook right underneath, one of the great Shakespearean directors of the 20th century, and he's still around too. Orson Welles right up at the top, starting out, you know, in radio and in theater. Lloyd Richards, who directed a lot of the August Wilson plays and brought that cycle to life. Konstantin Stanislavski, right up at the top, artistic director of the Moscow Art Theater. And Julie Taymor, director of, not the director of Spider-Man, she was fired from that job,
right.
But the director of like The Lion King and many other great works. Just really a wonderful, I think, just an absolutely wonderful director. Well, what I have right up there, oh, and that's me from up doing summer stock at the Paul Bunyan Playhouse in Bemidji, where we also did the dragon boat races on Lake Bemidji, too, and we all wore different hats up there, so that's me preparing to direct, preparing to go boating. What I'm going to do is put this up for a moment. Let's see if I can do this, and just cover this up and see if we can answer that sentence. A director is like, if we just want to... A director is like a sheep dog. Tell me more.
It's all about psychology and the way you use your eyes.
Uh-huh. And a herding thing.
And
yeah, getting
generally move in the direction of the product.
A director is like a sheep dog. Anything else? Another image.
Gardener.
It's like a gardener.
Pulls weeds.
Uh-huh. Waters, fertilizes,
right.
Tends.
Also plants.
Plants.
A gardener.
Oh, he plants things, yes. Plants, puts the seeds in, watches them grow, waters them, takes care of them. A director is like a...
Tyrant.
Is like a tyrant. A tyrant. Meaning a director is like, you've worked a lot at the Guthrie. I don't know why you said that. So is a dictator, a ruler, a leader? Yeah.
Yeah, had to come into rooms and say this is not a democracy.
I think there are many that would just say they're like a god.
They are like a god, yeah. They create the entire world of the production, yeah. So that universe is molded, shaped by the director. A director is like, we're looking for synonyms, others. It's like a nanny, yeah. I have felt that way. Not because I can fly through the air with an umbrella. Because I can, of course.
A conductor.
It's like a conductor. There we go. Yeah. Talk a little bit more about that, how like a conductor.
That you don't play an instrument, and yet the entire performance is dependent on your getting instruments to play together in a beautiful manner.
And you're interpreting what?
Interpreting a score.
A score,
or
the creative work of a composer or something, or whomever. Yeah.
Right, and your way of interpreting that is the substantial difference in what the production actually ends up being. Like, there's a lot of different philosophies as in conducting on how to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Yep, very close analogy, yeah. Any others? We have sheepdog, gardener, tyrant, god, nanny, and conductor.
Factory foreman. Yeah, there's all these physical things that have to be fabricated or created.
Yeah, which gets maybe a little bit at the sort of really the nuts and bolts kind of thing that has to happen. You know, all the parts need to be put together.
Literally.
Yes, so you can get a car at the end of the assembly line or something like that. Yeah. You can also say artist, like
the stages of canvas.
That's right, yeah. So you're like an artist, the stage is your canvas, yeah?
Maybe a prophet.
Prophet. And say more about that, prophet.
Well, they have to bring in material that's been given to them, but they have to get a picture of what it's going to look like before it happens.
Yeah.
So maybe they're a self-prophet, I don't know how much they pass that on. They have to pass on a vision.
Yeah, so they're filled with the Spirit. Can we even go that far?
Yeah, sure.
And they need to communicate it passionately, persuasively.
Yes. And they need to forward it. They need people to picture it.
Yeah.
Getting from what
they need to take whatever they have and and get that message out. Oh, that's great.
Kind of a subset of artists, sculptor.
Yep.
You're creating space in three dimensions.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so you're taking the big chunk of wood, marble, plaster, whatever, too, and you're hacking away at it until a shape emerges.
Parrot.
Yeah, I was just going to say parrot.
Yes.
Just going
to. And that relationship, I mean, don't you think there is like a lot of relationship in the rehearsal process where you feel like that need for approval and trying to get to what that director wants?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's sometimes along that the kind of shaman one, you know, the ones that come in as a sort of intentionally spiritual sort of.
Yeah, a little bit of the sort of shaman guru kind of like,
guru.
They're just so magical. How do they do that? Yeah.
Or they cultivate that at least as their persona.
Yeah. So is it like a little bit sort of the artist as madman? You know, of just sort of the crazed visionary, you know, goes along with the prophet and stuff like that.
Carpenter or a contractor, you know, they take the blueprint and make it into the real thing, and you take the plate
off the paper and make it into the... Yeah. I know, it's very interesting because it's not a profession that's really been codified, you know, or even just the training that you would go to become a director isn't in agreement on this, but everyone would agree that, they could see a successful director being very much like any of these and probably three times as many other words that we could put up there. And a lot of times they tend, not surprisingly, to sort of fall into a little bit of that sort of left brain, right brain kind of categories where you have sort of the foreman, the contractor, you know, maybe the conductor and things like that that might seem like this is the person who's a sort of project manager kind of thing, who's taking a budget, a timeline, a group of people, given an assignment, it needs to have a deadline getting you to this point. But then it's also sort of married with this sort of shaman, prophet, artist kind of visionary talent, you know, hard to put your finger on kind of qualities right there.
A counselor,
yeah.
Sausage.
Sausage. There we have.
One interesting distinction I've heard up, and I don't know where I stand in this myself, but between creator versus interpreter, where does a particular director place himself in that kind of
fabulous segue? I think as we walk through the production process, we will see. Let's see if I'm remembering right what I have coming up next, too. So we have all these different kind of directors who have all these different approaches and different kinds of skills, but they're doing a very similar kind of thing, trying to get to opening night, with a play. Maybe just to step back and just do a little bit sort of a background. A lot of people say, oh, directing just really has only been around about 100 years or so. I don't know that that's really the case. We just called it different things, or we don't have a lot of information, maybe because that whole the whole process is so kind of squishy or something. But in the Greek theater, in the golden age of Greeks, in the 5th century BC, the didaskalos, the teacher, was often the person who wrote the play, so that could have been Aeschylus writing the Oresteia, who was maybe playing Agamemnon and another part in there, and was telling the chorus and the other characters what to do. And they didn't have a lot of other technical elements. There weren't lights that needed to be focused and hung and stuff like that. Sound cues would have all been live and stuff like that, and probably fairly rudimentary, maybe by our standards too. But I think really that the writer, lead actor, would have been also the director right there. In the medieval theater, when they were doing all of the miracle, mystery, morality plays, and they were doing a lot of big religious dramas, like you see this one right over here. This is, it's just like the martyrdom of Saint somebody or another, too, is the name of it. But it's one of the only images that we have of one of these medieval sort of big tableau kind of things with all of these different, sort of scenes or stations that you could go around and see all of these different scenes from the martyr's life right there. And here we have the pageant master right in the center right there. Again, the conductor, right there, and with the text in his hand. So someone who was really coordinating all of those elements right there. For a long period of time, really from about the time of Shakespeare, who was an actor, a writer, and also one of the owners of his particular troupe right there, along with a couple of the others. We don't actually know, I don't think, really who directed them, but I can only assume it probably was Shakespeare or Richard Burbage, the lead actor, who were probably sharing a lot of those duties. And that was a tradition of the actor-manager or the producer-manager sort of taking care of a lot of that. Really up into the early 1900s, you still had that. And, even people like Laurence Olivier and John Gielgud had stints earlier in their career where they were actor managers. They were producing, they were directing it, they were playing the leading role.
Molière
is a great example. Had his own company, wrote the plays, starred in the plays, directed them. But a lot of theater historians point to this dude, of all people, Georg II, the Duke of Saxe-Meiningen. Well, he had his little German principality, so he had a lot of resources at hand, and he loved theater. So what he did is he actually created a little theater in his castle, and he brought in a whole bunch of actors and other people in the theater, and they put on plays there. But he thought he wanted to do that because he thought, you know what, it is just, it really disturbed him that, the costumes weren't historically accurate. They would do scenes in the backdrop wouldn't be right, the colors clashed and things like that. He thought if there was a greater unity in this storytelling, if we could coordinate that stuff a little bit better, well, my gosh, our shows would probably be a lot better too. So he spent a lot of time and a lot of his own money doing just that. And so there you really have the genesis of the really sort of the modern director coming to play. Not surprisingly, he was doing this at the end of the 19th century, so it's right at the time when things like gaslight was being readily used and electric light was coming in. So the actor-manager on stage could no longer see exactly what he looked like, how the lights were focused and things like that. So it was the introduction of technology into the theatrical experience that I think really required having someone sitting out in the house, in the auditorium, watching the stage picture and helping that along. And then a lot of
the technical director, right?
And really, yeah. So taking, overseeing a lot of those technical aspects as those were developing. And as I said before, Konstantin Stanislavski, artistic director of the Moscow Art Theater, and wrote a lot of these really seminal books just on acting and what we think of as sort of the basis of modern realistic acting. He also worked with Anton Chekhov on a lot of the big Chekhovian plays, The Seagull, Uncle Vanya, Three Sisters, Cherry Orchard. He was a huge advocate of realism, not only in the acting, but in all aspects of the production. So for preparing for The Cherry Orchard, which takes place on a big Russian estate, the company went out one summer and lived on a big Russian estate, sort of getting into all of their roles right there, and then came back and were able to bring a greater reality to that. So adding that dimension or that kind of approach to the way you're going to create theater really is bringing us right into the 20th century, and then a lot of the, and we can take off from there for the pictures of a lot of the other people earlier on.
I'm wondering, does method acting emerge from his work, or?
Because a lot of people in the United States and England heard about Stanislavski. They saw in like in the 1920s, when he was still around, they came and they went to New York and they went to London. People saw them, it was revolutionary. And a lot of people went and studied there. So you have a lot of people in the group theater. Let's see, like Ilya Kazan, Harold Klerman. So a lot of the people who were then went on to direct like Streetcar Named Desire, Death of a Salesman, and a lot of those sort of cornerstone productions were people who either learned or studied with Stanislavski or their teachers did. So there was, everything in the theater seems to happen a little bit by tradition and by this handing off from one generation to the next. And this that would be a perfect example of that, where you can see that infiltrating and just taking over. So then you had people like Lee Strasberg, who would be another one of those who started the Actors Studio. Yep, that Marilyn Monroe, Marlon Brando, and everyone else went to in the 1950s, and our whole generation of actors came out mumbling, you know. No, no, there were just brilliant, brilliant actors who came out there, too. So that was a way that that theatrical tradition really informed all the theater that we do in the United States, a little less so in England, because they had another strong tradition, both of plays, directors, and approaches to theater, but it still really informed a lot of how things happen. So let's just talk, just sort of generally, as if maybe we're directors, and we'll touch on the roles of some of the other people in the theatrical process. The first thing is getting hired. Well, usually, unless you're associated, like as an artistic director, with another company or have your own company, pretty much you're a freelance person. That's what I am. So I work at a lot of different theaters, and Sam is a freelance actor then, too. Works at a lot of different theaters. Usually, depending on, you know, where you are and what you want to do, I usually end up doing 4 to 8 shows a year, and I go back and forth between acting and directing. So probably like this year, I'll end up doing about 8 shows a year. This is kind of a lot. Yeah. I feel tired already. And if we look at, generally, directors get hired, obviously have to get hired before actors. So I find, as I start doing more directing, I get asked to do other shows before those shows are cast. So I end up doing, I'm ending up doing a little more directing than acting, just because those are the gigs that come along earliest. Usually you might get hired as a director about a year in advance. So when a theater, let's just say, you know, any kind of regional theater is planning next year's season, I wonder what we're going to do, and it might be a year or a year and a half in advance, then they might be thinking about plays, or they might be thinking about directors that they want to call in. And so then you would get the gig then at about this point, and you go around getting hired as a director through the usual. You could send out your resume, you could do a lot of networking, and what that means in the theater is going to a lot of other people's shows and telling them how good they were and how much you're interested in their work and asking them about their work. It could mean going to a lot of theater parties, and there are a lot of theater parties. Well, there are. I mean, that's what I do. I go. There were many years I went down to the to Lanesboro, Minnesota, which is always just fine just to do, and you know, said hi to Hal Kropp, who's the artistic director of the small Commonweal Theater down there too. And I tell you, like 3 years in a row, by the end of that weekend when I left, I had a show for the following year. Because we were just down there in front of them, they're just like, oh yeah, and you talk about theater, you talk about their upcoming season, what they're gonna be doing, you know. So throw yourself in front of the train, yeah. You can go around, you can do informational interviews, which is a, you know, a little more formalized way of doing that. You can offer to work as an assistant director. That would be another way. Or you could just simply propose projects to theaters, to artistic directors as they're preparing for their next year's season. So that's what's happening like a year to a year and a half in advance of opening night for your show. What you're working with, producers and different theater companies, and they all have different aesthetics, different kinds of shows they want to do, different audiences that they serve. And so you're trying to fit in and make sure that your show is serving the needs of that organization. You are working probably for an artistic director, unless you are an artistic director yourself, then you're working for the board of directors, really. There's probably a parallel position of a managing or executive director, not surprisingly, that's the person who takes care of all the finances, the facility, and all of that kind of stuff that go on at particularly larger theaters that have their own theater. the designers might be people that you would suggest, say, hey, I want to bring in so-and-so to do the set, and this I've got this costume, it's going to be great. The artistic director might have people, or they might have people on staff that they will assign to you. So it works in different ways at different times. The theater will probably also have the building crew who's going to, including like a technical director overseeing all of that construction of the set. They might have a costume staff or just a costumer, and they might bring in some freelance people to help with that. Almost inevitably, you as the director of the production are going to be hiring the actors, so you're going to be doing the auditions and taking care of that. Usually the theater will also have a stage manager, the person who's going to be going alongside you throughout the whole rehearsal process and staying with the show throughout the entire run, making sure that that show maintains its artistic integrity and runs smoothly throughout the whole process. That stage manager would then be overseeing the actors once the show opens, and also any sort of running crew. Now that might be if the stage manager is up in the booth. There's probably a light board and a soundboard operator. The stage manager is probably on a headset with the assistant stage manager backstage. You may have a couple people, if you have to do like a big scene change, you might have a couple people back there. Other people who might be helping with costumes and stuff like that, depending on the scale of the production.
Manager is usually part of that theater. It's not like you have stage managers that you would tag along and say, hey, I want to work with this person.
It totally depends on the theater.
But it does happen that you would bring your own stage manager?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because a lot of times, maybe even at a mid-level or certainly a smaller theater, people are like, oh, man, do you know any good stage managers? We just lost ours. And was just like, yes, I will have Penny come in and do this. I've already talked to her.
And often the who's directing will attract certain people.
That's right. Yeah, sense. So it's all about relationships, community, and networking. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the time that it's usually in your 8 shows a year. I'm trying to do the math.
Yeah.
That's
so you're overlapping, yeah. Overlapping. Yeah.
Okay, so you set one loose and then go, you could be working on one at the same time?
That's right, yeah.
That's kind of hard, isn't it?
You're usually only in rehearsal for one because that's right. The most intense, specific time commitment.
Well, like your tech week and
yeah,
such.
Or that 4 to 6 weeks before opening night, too, that you'll see, yeah. Huh. But, so for example, right now, when I get, the Monday I get back, next Monday, I'll go into rehearsal for Lysistrata at Theater in the Round. That'll open at the beginning of September. Then I'm acting in a show at Torch Theater, which will open at the beginning of October. And then I think I have a couple other projects that I will find out more about when I get back.
Yeah. I could see directing in the acting piece, but not too directing and overlapping.
It's actually a little bit easier to overlap that. It's harder to overlap when you're acting,
because
you got to be there every performance. So I've got a long run. Right. Really can't be acting in another show at the same time.
You may have answered my question, but once opening night comes, how often do you see the show?
Usually, you're not required at all. It can be your last time with that particular project.
Mm-hmm. Is that the case with you? I mean,
I often go back closing night. You know, if it's a show I'm directing in the Twin Cities, you know, I like to keep in touch. Usually, a lot of my friends and colleagues are there. There might be something that the theater is doing, you know, a special night for donors even or something like that, where I'll go back, or a student group is coming, they want to do a post-show discussion. Mm-hmm. So I'll be back, I'll watch the show again. There may be occasions where I might even pass along some notes to the stage manager. It's like,
fix it
a little slow, yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Previews, often there are changes suggested.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be there, and how radical are those changes?
For shows that I'm directing.
Right. I know you're perfect.
I don't have too many changes that I end up doing. Most of the shows that I work on tend to be sort of mid-level or smaller theater kind of shows.
Okay.
So like Sam works at the Guthrie and CTC a lot, and you guys have much longer preview and tech schedules then too, where there might be more substantive kind of changes, and they can afford to make bigger changes. They can say, no, I don't like it, it needs to be something different. And they don't really, well, they do.
Do you ask for comments from the preview audiences?
Usually what happens if I'm working for an artistic director, then the artistic director will probably come and watch first preview and give some feedback, some notes or something like that. Or I might invite a couple friends, colleagues to come in and say, hey, why don't you come to a dress rehearsal before first preview and watch and tell me what you see. And then during previews, a lot of it is more just watching the show in front of an audience and seeing how the audience is reacting, how the applause is landing, how the timing of the show. There's just so much that the actors can learn during that process too. So we all sort of go through that, in my case, go through that process together. So let's talk a little bit about sort of earlier on. So you've got the show, it's a year before opening night, what do you do? So before you start meeting with your designers, doing any casting or any rehearsals, it's you and the script. And this is really that period from about 1 year to about maybe even 4 months before opening. And what you're doing is reading the play again, doing any research that you want to do on it. There might be a little bit of lining up of who the designers are, how you want to do the audition and casting process. And if you're working like maybe with a classic play, let's take Shakespeare since we were just talking about that yesterday, you know, maybe you think like, ooh, King Lear is really big. I know I want to cut that down. So what does that mean? It means going through the text, cutting it. It could be a little bit of rearranging the text a little bit. There's going to be a lot of, you might even have someone going along with you, a dramaturg, who would be sort of a literary manager kind of person who might be able to say, well, here's the first folio, here's the good quarto, here's the bad quarto, or whatever it is, and help you go through, look up words, do a little research and stuff like that. Or if you're working with a living playwright who might actually be with you, maybe it's your first production, during this time you actually might get a group of actors together, do a reading of the play. You might workshop the play. So you go and do a couple rehearsals, have a couple other people come in and watch that, and just do a staged reading or something like that. And then you can go through a couple of iterations of the script. So all of those things are possibilities. And all of this is leading up to this part, is developing what you want to say or do with your particular production. Now, when I was going to school, throughout like the 1980s, which was a long time ago, and in the 1980s up until the 90s, we talked about the concept. What kind of concept do you want to put on it? And I don't really hear that very much. And younger directors are like, no. They usually talk much less formally about it. And they say, well, what do you want to do with the show? Or what is your kind of take on the script going to be? And that's when they're saying, are you changing the time period? You know, is it going to be set in Nazi Germany or something like that? Is it going to be on the moon for The Tempest or something? So that's really, just as it says up here, you're figuring out, what does this play mean? How does it say what it says? What is the author going after? What does it mean to you? What's the most important thing you want to say with this particular production? Why another Midsummer Night's Dream? What do you want to say or do with that? And then you just really need to get that under your belt, and you need to be able to like give people the sort of elevator speech really quickly on that, so you can talk to your designers about that in one way, you talk to your actors about it in another way, but the same, it's going to be the same core kind of things, but you're going to want to approach them slightly differently. You're going to want to talk to the audience, whether it's a post-show discussion or to the PR people at the theater beforehand so they can write a good and accurate press release, and to the producers so that you can keep them informed. This is the kind of show I'm delivering for your theater. It's going to be a big runaway hit, and it's not going over budget.
Talk to designers first about that.
This is one way that you can go about kind of thinking about this. This is a fun, I think a fun little exercise. I really liked it when I first heard about it. As you look at a script, you look at a play script, all scripts have five different elements in drama, in play scripts. All plays have them. Most playwrights usually end up emphasizing or pulling forward like one or two of these elements. And so with a playwright, they're really saying, this is the kind of thing I'm most interested in and what I want to say and how I want to say it. As a director, it starts to inform, this is the kind of production that we should create. This lets the actor know, oh yeah, this is the kind of production that I'm in. For the audience, this is where any sort of audience member can figure out, this is the kind of play I like, and I don't like those other kind of plays because they're this kind of play. So any guesses? What are the five elements of drama? All play scripts, when you read them, have what?
Characters.
They have characters.
Setting.
They have, yeah, so they have a setting, yeah.
Conflict. Or a problem.
Yes, so there's a theme.
A time frame, or setting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. usually the characters are telling
a narrative.
So there's a story. So characters are telling a story. The story is about something. There's a theme.
Is conflict part of that, or
it is because it's all delivered through what?
Through words.
So there's language in there that you need to pay attention to. And there's also, we've touched on it a little bit. Yeah, there's a visual element. Usually people just call it spectacle. So there's a physical production element. So you have those five different areas that all plays have, and different kinds of plays. This is just a picture of some flowers up on the little Bighorn Mountains that I passed over. Anyway, it was a pretty picture. It's a new camera. So they have a story.
Green flowers alone.
This is my spectacle. This is the spectacle. This is language. I am a character. Story, characters, there's a theme, there's language, and there's spectacle in there. Think a little further. Tell me what kinds of plays, just sort of general genres or playwrights or specific play titles that mainly are driven by the story. What happens next? What kind of plays are those? Or who writes those?
A mystery.
Mysteries, thrillers, a lot of TV shows are all, you know.
The bars.
Yes, what happens next? Yeah. Melodramas. So everything that's driven by the story, you know, the characters, yeah, they're fine or whatever. The theme, it might not really be about anything other than the story itself, you know. You must pay the rent. I can't pay the rent. The language, it doesn't really matter. They're just really driven plot-wise and spectacle. Maybe there's some, there's always elements of some of these other things, but usually not that much. How about like character plays, where just like they're realistic, individual, unique, rich kind of characters? Sitcoms might be kind of like that. Yeah. And sitcoms often don't have a lot of story to them, too. Yeah. Because even by the name, they're situation comedies. So they have a situation, but there's not a long storyline, unless you're watching like an evening drama or you know, something like that that goes on and on and on. Then it's story driven.
Hamlet would be an example if we think of character driven.
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. And what were we talking about before? Konstantin Stanislavski. Soon I'll be able to say that name. So Chekhov. So Chekhov is considered one of the supreme sort of character dramatists. And since Stanislavski influenced so much of the American theater, really most of what we think of as the great 20th century American plays are character-driven plays. You know, Willie Loman, Blanche DuBois, George and Martha in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, you know, Eugene O'Neill, Long Day's Journey Into Night, all of those are, you know, they're richly detailed, very specific, rooted, grounded people with a lot of emotional depth, psychological realism to them. And so those writers are primarily interested, you know, Long Day's Journey Into Night doesn't have a lot to do with story. You get it in the title. It's just the family sitting around getting more and more anxious about that. How about theme? Theme plays. Mm-hmm. Or the theme or the idea.
Restoration comedy.
Could be. Yeah. I can see that, yeah, because they're all social comedy of manners.
Yes.
So they're, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Angels in America.
Perfect.
Ooh.
Gold star. Ooh. Yes. Yeah. Angels in America.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's perfect.
Brecht.
Brecht, yes. Brecht, yes. So anything that's going to be like a social, political, or religious drama, they're trying to bring that theme, that story forward.
Clifford Odets.
Yeah, so Clifford Odets would be. A lot of Shaw's plays are driven by the theme, you know. August Wilson. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Language plays.
Shakespeare,
anything that we know written in verse or something like that, and poetic dramas and things like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gilbert and Sullivan as a language play. That's
interesting.
I certainly associate.
I think classic comedies are all language plays. Any good comedy is a language play. It doesn't really matter who the characters are, what the story is about, what the theme is, as long as that joke lands for a modern play like Neil Simon. It's about, is the joke well crafted? Oscar Wilde, it's about, is it a good epigram, you know? So comedies are language plays too.
Yeah.
And spectacle?
Musicals
are spectacles. Cats, Spider-Man, we could go on and on. Here's an interesting one though. I don't know, does anyone know War Horse?
Yeah. Oh, I saw that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, we're on Broadway, where it's not a musical, but it is a big spectacle show where they have, where you actually see the horse, and it's amazing puppetry with very articulated musculature. So you can see really the horse moving. It's just an astonishing theatrical device.
My son worked with one of the teachers of the movement of that, of one of the horses.
Oh my gosh.
In Lincoln Center. And one of the things that this guy, that Sarah Lawrence was talking about, and I saw them do some other puppetry stuff, is the breathing of the puppet.
Yeah.
Matching the breathing.
The puppeteer.
Yeah, the puppeteer. Yeah. The breathing, and you can see the horse breathing, and it just comes to life. And how the larger puppets, which you would think, with people controlling them, would seem less intimate, but they become more intimate, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And the theatrical imagination that is released both from performers and audience is kind of extraordinary.
It's extraordinary.
That. And the interesting thing is when that first came out, Steven Spielberg grabbed the film rights, just a very standard, realistic film without no puppetry or anything. It didn't do very well because I'm such a genius, the story, the characters, the theme, and the language were all very standard and somewhat prosaic, too. It's nice. It's a good story. But there's nothing extraordinary about it. What was extraordinary and moving was the theatrical spectacle that they put
together. The video.
Yeah.
Well, Lion King is that way.
The Lion King is exactly that same way, too. Yeah. It's, yeah. So this is just what we've said before. A lot of the same ones, yeah. Movies, not so much on language, it's a visual medium. And the, what about Shakespeare? We sort of mentioned Shakespeare immediately with language. The thing about Shakespeare, this is why we love Shakespeare, you had mentioned Hamlet. So the story of Hamlet, it's about a guy whose father has been murdered and he has to revenge someone. There are big sword fights, there's a play within a play, there's all kinds of stuff, leaping into the grave, there's a mad scene and stuff like that. It's great on story. Characters, yeah, Hamlet, Gertrude, Ophelia, Claudius, even down to the Gravedigger, amazing parts, terrific at characters. Theme, yes, I think we'd all agree, Shakespeare knows what he's talking about, he's talking about big universal themes. Yep, it's one of the cornerstones of Western drama, the language is transcendent, and spectacle, yep, you can do a lot with spectacle because of a lot of the things in the story. The problem with Shakespeare is it fulfills all of these so strongly that as a director, what you have to do is say, okay, what do I want to emphasize? I can't do everything with this show. It's one way to help focus a specific production. Since we were talking, a lot of us were talking about King Lear yesterday, for me, it's always going back to the story. And for something like King Lear to say, once upon a time, there was a very old king who wanted to divide up his kingdom. He had three daughters. Two of them were very, very beautiful, but very, very evil. One was very, very beautiful and very, very good. You know, you can go through the whole thing. It sets up really like a fairy tale. And I think that's the easiest way for contemporary audiences to get drawn into Shakespeare, if they can latch onto the archetypal story and go along. Then all of these other things fall into place. And this doesn't become a problem. It just becomes a beautiful support to the story. So if you can do that, when you're doing... by a lesser dramatist like Ibsen. I love Ibsen, I don't mean that at all. But if you're doing another play where you can see it, it's important to recognize, let's just take an example, like if you're doing A Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, a great character play, but you really want to emphasize the story, what happens next? It's just like, dude, you're doing the wrong show. It all takes place in the bedroom, we're just waiting to find out if Big Daddy has cancer. And if that baby is real or not, too. So it's just a situation. There's no story. You'll get no traction. You won't have a good production. So knowing what kind of play you're in and where to put the value in, and then if you're a theater-going audience, to say, you know what? I like musicals. It's the same. I like spectacle. And I like music, you know. Or I like any of these others. I like plays that are about something, that have some meat. a good drama or something that says something to me. What I want to touch. Does that kind of make sense, you know? The other thing as a director that you can do is if you're looking at that, you might realize that there are areas, I'm doing this kind of play, but this kind of play has some faults in this other area. And what you might want to do, I should have a better example, I can't think of one right now too, is you want to try to cover those tracks a little bit for a faultier play. So if you realize one is a little deficient in some area, like a play might be super, super talky, and you want to add some spectacle around it. You know, so like you're going to have these marvelous sort of scene transitions or something like that too, where a lot of people will come on and they'll dance around and do something like that. So when you go back to just talking, you will have had a little breather from that. Here's just one example of a concept. This is King Lear once again. I had this group called Shakespearean Youth Theater. These were homeschool kids in St. Paul, Minneapolis. And we did a class in the fall, and then we had to do a show in the winter. They meet in Randolph Heights Presbyterian Church in St. Paul. It's just like the most tired fellowship hall in the basement of this poor old church. Oh, my gosh. And that's where they do the show. Previously, they had brought in like bleachers and risers and tried to hang lights and make it like a theater. So they're putting all of this expense, all of these resources into this really, this place would never look like a theater. And could never really do a very good show. So the only other, because I'm also the manager of the James J. Hill House, the only thing I could think of that I could get them into, so I said, let's do an environmental theater project too, where we're going to do it site-specific in the Hill House. My concept was, no longer in America do we have kingdoms that get divided up, but we do have corporate empires that do get divided up. Neither James J. Hill or Mary Hill had a will when they died. There was huge family dissension that just literally tore the family apart, and there were huge court battles and things like that. So I taught them a little bit about the history of the site, and then we went and we did the show there. So you have this huge staircase in this big Gilded Age mansion with King Lear sitting right up on the top and the daughters down over here, and the audience gathered around this enormous staircase right there. We did all the whole first part of it. At the end of our first act, Lear gets thrown out into the heat. The storm is going to happen. And what we ended up doing is closing all the pocket doors that went around this big hallway. So it all closed off, slam, 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 slam. And then we said, it's intermission. Pick up your chairs. Act two will be in the basement. So the audience was as discombobulated and disoriented as King Lear, and everyone went down to the servants' quarters in the basement where it's all marble and pipes and things like that. And that's where we did. The storm was down there. It was so loud. Everything was so echoey and things like that. Plucking out of Gloucester's eyes, Death of the Fool, Cordelia, Lear, and stuff like that all took place downstairs. So no one was allowed back up into the castle anymore. So that would be an example of a pretty high concept, site-specific kind of thing. So that's an example of that. I'm running out of time. Oh well, working with designers. Then you're gonna start working with all of these people who are gonna support you in all the physical production of that, of your show. A lot of times if you're doing a low budget show, like Uncle Vanya that I did at Gremlin Theater, a smaller theater that I was acting in and I wrote the adaptation, we had woman named Tamitha Miller who was working with a really small set budget. So we found all the pieces of furniture, but we said, okay, there's going to be no walls right in there, too. We don't need walls, you know, because they're hard to build if you don't have any budget or a TD. But she was a wonderful painter, so it shows up a little bit right there, but there was a beautiful impressionistic Russian landscape across the back. Very evocative and very wistful, perfect for a Chekhov. So she put all her time and effort and resources into that, and it totally worked for that. So it's usually set in costumes that are taking up most of your budget, but sometimes, if you're doing, this is me, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane that we did at Torch Theater, Stacia Rice played the Betty Davis part, and I played the Joan Crawford part. This would be an example where you're putting a lot more emphasis on wigs, costume, and makeup right there, because you want that to be kind of the centerpiece right there. You might also end up needing to bring on people who are doing either dance choreographers or fight choreographers to help with either sword play or physical violence, hand-to-hand kind of combat. You're working with these people a couple months, you usually start working 2 to 3 months before rehearsals begin or about 3 months before opening. Yeah. This is one thing it took me a while to learn since I come from an acting background and an English major background, is all of these people express themselves through non-verbal, non-written kind of ways. This is how they say who they are and what they do. So learning how to deal with people that way and working in metaphors, bringing in research, pictures, is so much more helpful when you're doing that. It took me a long time to learn that. This is an example of a really good designer who did, this is Liz Estrada that I'm going to be doing again at Theater in the Round. This is the first set design. I didn't like it because it didn't give us a lot of the movement that we needed around there. He came back, he did that. I know, it's like totally different. We realized this was clashing a lot with the costumer's palette that the costumer was coming up with. We then went to this to mute all of the colors. But the dilemma that I have when I go back to Minneapolis is I actually like this one better. So we have to find a way that we can sort of reconcile those things. And so bringing those different design units together into an harmonious whole is what it's all about. Street Scene, Elmer Weiss's gritty New York drama, 1929, that I directed about a year ago. The design, really good designers did a lot of photography research to find out what these tenement houses look like, how we could express that in the theater garage, a very low, the play is written so you'd see people in the first, second, and third floors up there. Mm-hmm. We had a wide space, but not a tall space. We did two tenements next to each other. It worked out really well. We did a lot of work with the artworks of that time period to try to get us towards the color palette that we wanted to have, and we ended up with sort of the more of the black and white for the set, and with the color coming through a little bit more in the costume to sort of do the sort of black and white photograph, but then the characters are pulling out in front of that too to give it more dimension and more vibrancy to the people. So it's going back and forth and share, doing that kind of research and stuff like that. Oh, those are two of my headshots up there in the corner. Auditions and casting, that usually happens several, you know, 1 to 6 months before the show opens, or even before you go into rehearsal. There's always the question of, do you audition, as a director, do you audition or not audition? Is there pre-casting? Are you working with a company of actors, so are you just using those people? Are you filling out that cast? Are you doing open auditions? Anyone can come in. Are you doing invited auditions? You just want to see a limited number of people, or for a limited number of roles. All of those things you work with your producer to find out how to do it. Generally, there are two approaches to auditions when actors come in. It can either be cold readings, readings from the script, where you get like a side or a monologue, a short scene, that you may end up reading with a scene partner. You may do this, isn't this fascinating, Sam? You may read it with a reader. They may bring in another actor who just reads with everybody. Or, worst case scenario, you end up reading with the stage manager who's not an actor and probably doesn't really want to be there doing that at that time. Especially if
and doesn't think you're funny.
And doesn't think you're funny at all. The other alternative would be to do a prepared piece. So the actor may have just in their arsenal, you know, their classical drama, their classical comedy, their modern drama or something. You might be asked to do two contrasting pieces, maybe up to a total of 4 minutes or whatever it's going to be. A lot of times that's used more in the bigger professional theaters. It would be used more for general auditions, that if a theater is auditioning for a whole season of plays and they just want to see a whole bunch of people, then you would do that. A lot of times I ask people to do a prepared piece for Shakespeare just because cold reading Shakespeare is usually hard for a lot of people to do. But once you hear people at a first round audition, at a general audition, then you will just call back for another day, usually, to have people read from the script to see what fit works best. Yeah?
My son had his first Skyped audition.
Oh, yeah.
That's interesting.
I've had people this year saying, hey, can I submit a video audition? I'm out of town.
No, but not the video. It's a live.
Yeah.
He was sent the script ahead of time all electronic. Everything like
that. Yeah. But then done live then.
Yeah. Skype.
Or whatever. Yeah, Skype. Yeah.
Craig, when you're doing auditions, how much, I mean, you've got to let the actors know what your take on the play is. Otherwise, they'll come in with a.
Yeah, so you can tell them a little bit about it if
but
it's
do
something
that at
they,
the audition
yeah.
or in advance or how do you do that?
Part of that is the actor's responsibility to know the play, to read the play beforehand. So you really have to sort of meet halfway. So if the actor does that kind of preparation, and you have, if you're looking for something really specific, you can ask that person to do it. Well, let's say you're doing Death of a Salesman. A lot of people know and are familiar with what, maybe what Willie Loman should sound like, should look like, you know, or Biff's son, something like that, Linda the Light. So people should have generally have the right take. So for an initial audition, it's just seeing if they're the general type. Here's the thing about auditions. It's really the job interview for actors. So really you're making that decision, the initial one, before you do callbacks when you're making a final decision. So your initial job interview is based on your gender, is based on your age, often based on your race, what you look like. So it's all of those basic, all of the things that we cannot do in other areas.
Interesting.
Yeah. So unless you're doing the kind of show where you're just going to totally open that up, which is great, but there's a lot of shows where you probably are not going to do that. If you're doing The Miracle Worker, you're probably not going to have an African-American Annie Sullivan to come in and say, I am an Irish immigrant. You know, based, especially for a play based on a very well-known historic character, you know. It's just like, what kind of mountain do you want to climb, you know?
August Wilson's got those.
There we go, yeah. Tennessee Williams says it has to be performed by the gender as written. Yeah, because there's been a lot of all-male glass menageries. Yuck.
At one time, when Sam Rep did the cherry orchard, and they had an Asian lead female, and it was very disconcerting for most of the audience.
A lot of people that just start asking questions or wanting to know about that, and if that's really what you want to talk about, if that's what your concept is, then that's what people will talk about. So that's just a choice, a really major decision that you make.
Yeah.
Right now in St. Paul, it's Theater Move, which is an Asian American theater company, but they're doing Into the Woods, fairy tale musical, totally from an Asian theater aesthetic with you. And
just fine.
Beautiful, yeah. Yeah, it's weird how somebody, it's just like, oh, that seems great. The other, not so certain, yeah.
Well, that's, I mean, but the other, that's what Ms. Flood is trying to do.
Yeah, they do a lot of that, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know if you go to Mixed Blood that that's a specific theater that's doing that kind of thing. And you go there because you want to see that too. So that's you as the director saying, I get what your aesthetic is, and I want to be there, and I want to do that. And this is a good play that we can do that with. These are just a couple, you know, this would be about the length of material that you might have if you're coming in and auditioning for Our Town. So you might read through that scene. I might stop and start you and say, why don't you try it again this way? Or I might just let you read it and say, thanks, that was great. Judge Brack and Hedda Gabler. So it would be about that much material. This is a little bit from Lysistrata. You might do a monologue or something, which you might do as a cold reading, or you might come in with something as a prepared piece. The Duchess of York one is probably a little shorter than you would probably do. The Astra from Uncle Vanya would be good. Just maybe really quickly reading through this. Yes, we do cut down trees sometimes, but why destroy entire forests? The Russian forests tremble beneath your axe. Millions of trees are lost. Animals and birds flee their homes. Rivers dry up. Wetlands disappear. And landscapes that once dazzled our eye lie mutilated, gone forever. Romantic nonsense? I don't think so. A private obsession? So it seems. But when I step into a forest, I say, or hear the leaves rustle in a young birch I've just planted, then I think, I know that I have a tiny share in the life of our world. And if in 1,000 years people are happier, then I will have contributed to that. And my heart fills with pride. And with a twirl of his mustache, the doctor exits stage right to thunderous applause. Ha 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 ha. Look at your faces. A private obsession isn't a public crime. And so farewell. And the doctor leaves. This, I would say, this is a really good audition piece because it lets the actor do something really strong right up front. You can really become really soft and vulnerable right there. You can show his uncertainty right there, try to cover that up with a little bit of a fumbled witticism, and then take your leave after that. So if you can, within like a minute, show a couple really specific moments like that, and the ability to change and go from one to the other to the next, that's that's what a director is looking to see. Last few minutes, just moving into the rehearsal process, oh dear. Usually you start with table work, a read-through for the basic sense. Then everyone looks at you and you talk about your concept once again, what you're going to do with the show. I once had a director turn and say, well, I guess I really should tell you, I don't much care for this play. And that was the first thing when everyone turned and looked at her, which I think you learn things from good directors and you learn things from bad directors. But I thought, like, why in the world would you say that to your cast of people just as they're starting out on their journey right here, too? And in the second place, it was Twelfth Night. I know, come on. You know, it's just like a whole group of actors. It's like, we've been waiting all our lives to play this role. You know? depending on the rehearsal length, you might have a couple days where you're doing table work, sitting around the table, doing kind of like what a number of us were doing with King Lear with that opening scene. Reading it, stopping, starting, asking questions, discussing, determining what's the hard thing going to be. Refining the concept, maybe even getting up and doing some games or exercise if we want to do some ensemble building or something like that. Working rehearsals follow. That starts usually with staging, blocking the basic movements around the stage. Then it's usually going back over that, tearing it apart beat by beat. By this time, the actors know what they're doing, basically. They know where they're moving, basically. And then you can start just getting into the guts of the heart of the scene then. And usually you're going over all the material 2 to 3 times, hopefully. It usually takes you a couple weeks to do that. You move on to polishing rehearsals. This is putting the pieces together. You might do a stumble through where the show feels like it's 5 hours long or something. You'll do a designer run through. That's when the set costumes, lights, and stuff like that can come in and watch. Those are always a disaster. Because they never laugh at anything, because they're just looking like, oh my gosh, he stands on the furniture. Okay, the furniture has to support that. Okay, they're always over at the table, we'll put a lighting special over there. And so they're frantically just assessing what their work needs to be. But they're the first people, outside people, to see the show. And so I always feel as an actor, it's just like, this show sucks, I'm terrible. And then you're doing a lot of the tweaking, polishing, pulling it together, going into the run-throughs and things like that. Hopefully you'll have a day or two where you're on stage before you go into tech. And that's when you're doing the spacing rehearsals, getting used to the size of the theater, the actual layout from the rehearsal hall to the stage, what that looks like. Tech week is usually the week leading right up before opening or before first previews even. You may have already had a lot of the props and furniture earlier, if you're lucky. Then you start with a paper tech, writing all of the cues into the script, stage manager and designers doing that. A dry tech, no actors are there. You as the director are sitting there looking at one light cue, listening to the sound cue, tweaking it a little bit, so that when you get to the wet tech or a cue to cue when the actors are there, then you can move through that a little bit more quickly. These usually last at least 2 days. A lot of theaters do a 10 out of 12, which means you're working 10 hours out of a possible 12 hours, like 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. So everyone's there that whole time. You have a total of 2 hours off. The next day you can do an 8 out of 10, 8 hours out of a total of 10, maybe. So a lot of times, so that would be a typical Saturday, Sunday kind of thing, maybe. And then you would do, hopefully, 2 or 3 dress rehearsals that would follow those next couple days. And then you would be doing previews, which might be just one. Please, please try to have a preview. Or maybe even up to 7 or more, or with Spider-Man, years of previews, really. And then you get to opening night, and this is like the most distressing time for the director. You feel like you just have to sit out there and smile and look at everyone and meet the donors and the artistic director, you know, and all your friends and your mom is there and stuff like that too. But there's nothing you can do. It's totally, you've given the show away to the stage manager and the actors, as you should, and you just have to sit there and watch how it all rolls out. It's great if you can sit at the back of the house. If you can get backstage at intermission or something, or go hide somewhere, so you don't have to talk to anyone halfway through. Obviously right beforehand, then you're doing your thank yous to everyone involved. You're turning things over to the stage manager. And one sort of theater tradition is, and then the next morning you start the next project. So you don't try to hold on to it. You don't try to continue to control it. But you say, I did that. My job is done. It's their job now. and now I should start looking at something afresh, or take a vacation, or go to Holden, or something like that. we're out of time, you guys. Reviews, those are lovely, aren't they? I kind of mentioned this a little bit earlier. These are just two stories. Laughter on the 23rd floor, we had the director come back after a 6-week run 2 days before closing and give us notes. Even worse, I did the mousetrap at intermission of closing night. She came back after a 14-week run and gave us notes for Act Two. It was just like, really? Really? Very rarely do we have, she's a really good friend of mine. She's a terrific director too, but it's just like, honey. closing night, I like to come back on closing night, thank everyone again too, and continue on with the next project then. That's a kind of the 30,000 foot bird's eye overview of what it's like going from page to stage, yeah. Mm-hmm. Reading to opening night. There you go. Tomorrow it'll be building blocks and acting. A few more exercises if you want to participate, and games if you want to participate.